Welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts, with hosts Margaret Pickoff, Tom Butzler, and Tim Abbey.
Hello, and welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast from Penn State Extension for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts. I'm one of your hosts, Margaret Pickoff. I'm a horticulture educator with Penn State Extension, and on each episode, I'm joined by my colleagues on the Green Industry team as co-hosts. On today's episode, my co-hosts are Tom Butzler and Tim Abbey. So welcome, Tom and Tim.
Hey, Margaret.
Hey, Margaret. Hey, Tom.
Thanks for being here. Excited to talk with you guys. On today's episode, we'll be joined by Nash Turley from Penn State University's Department of Entomology. Before we get to our interview with Nash, we'll start out with a little check-in about what you're seeing out in the field at this time of year, which is early December, or what we're working on. So, Tim, what are you seeing or what are you doing these days?
A whole lot of gray. That's about it. It's a kind of a rainy day here today, which is actually nice. I haven't been out in the field much. I did make a site visit earlier this week to look at some yellow-bellied sapsucker damage on a blue Atlas cedar. So that was, you know, not particularly unusual, but something a little different. Don't see it all the time. But other than that, I've just been getting ready for the professional pest manager school program on Monday and then putting together speakers for our upcoming or some of my upcoming winter programs.
Nice. Was the sapsucker damage extensive? Do you think the tree will survive?
Right now, the tree actually looks pretty good, surprisingly, but I have seen cedars that have been, I'm assuming, killed off by them, because when I looked at them, they look really bad because those probing wounds that they make, you know, over years were just so much and just ruined so much cambium that the tree was done.
Hmm. Wow. Cool. Well, cool that you got to go out and see a tree this week.
Any excuse to get outside.
Yeah.
Unless it's like, you know, 20 degrees or below that and the wind's blowing, then I'm like, yeah, okay, I guess I'll go out.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Tom? Have you gotten to go on any site visits lately?
I did one a couple weeks ago. We're doing a lawn care video. And so I went out and did some video shooting of a hydro seeding project. And, you know, I've seen pictures and seen it from, you know, passing on a roadside, you know, some folks doing hydro seeding, but I actually got to see them mix up the slurry and add the grass seed. And I just never had seen that part of, lawn care. So that was kind of interesting. Now, on the other thing, I did get outside earlier in the week, and maybe kind of relevant to a little bit into today's discussion, is I popped the lid off of a couple of my beehives just to see how things were going and if I heard anything deeper down into the boxes. And I have just a couple hives in the backyard, and as of right now, there's still some humming going on down deep in the boxes. So I've left plenty of food behind. We'll just have to see how the rest of the winter progresses with them.
Hmm. Good.
How about you? What's going on in the eastern part of the state?
I was able to do a site visit last week at a Christmas tree farm. And it's actually the second Christmas tree farm I visited in a couple weeks. And it makes sense. It's coming up on the big season. I guess we're within the time when lots of people are getting their trees. And on one particular farm, saw a lot of diplodia, stem blight, and a mixture of that plus what looked like frost damage from, I don't know if you guys remember, but this May, just before Mother's Day, we had like a really, really, we had a bad frost one night, and the flower farm that I work on, you know, a lot of the dahlias got damaged because they were already up. But apparently some of these Christmas trees had just pushed out new growth, I guess, within the last couple weeks. And it was super delicate. And
what species was it? Concolors or?
I think Norway spruces, and some other type of spruces, because some of them hadn't really pushed out a whole lot of growth and they were okay, but the ones with new growth just got zapped. And I think in addition to, you know, we sent some samples into the lab and they came back positive for diplodia as well. So I think, you know, lots of stressors on conifers, this year with drought and then lots of rain all at once. So there's some disease pressure and weird frost happening in the spring. But it was fun for me. I mean, I know it's not great for the growers when we identify some disease, but it is always, when I open up those plant disease clinic reports, I'm always kind of excited to see what they found.
Yes. You cannot show your excitement when you go out into on the field visits.
No,
they're not happy.
You have diplodia. Yeah. Yeah. So fortunately for spruces, it's not usually that bad of a diagnosis. If it were pines, it would be a little bit more serious, but for spruces, it's usually not too bad. So yeah, I'm glad that we all got to get outside a little bit in the last couple of weeks, even though it's rainy and gray here today. Let's bring on our guest for today. Nash Turley is a postdoc researcher in the Department of Entomology at Penn State University, and we're so excited to have him on today. So welcome, Nash.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So can we start with just an overview of what you do, both for Penn State and outside of Penn State, just as a researcher and a scientist?
Yeah, I think my background is really more broadly as an ecologist. So I mostly study plants and some plant herbivore interactions, you know, up until when I came to Penn State, and now study bees pretty exclusively. And our research here is focused on bee biodiversity primarily. There's a lot of different species of bees out there. So we focus on studying the wide variety of bees that we have. And then, I think as a researcher, actually a lot of what I do is statistics, working with data, and then coordinating various projects as well.
I was sad to learn when I got to grad school for my master's how much of science is statistics, because it's something that I don't excel in necessarily,
pain.
But is the backbone of all science. And so certainly a big part of it. So what were you doing before you came to Penn State?
I've sort of changed a lot. Like my grad work was plant herbivore interaction. So I was studying really more about the evolutionary ecology of bugs interacting with plants, although also vertebrates interacting with plants. So one of the things I did was with rabbits, actually, where we had this long-term experiment that was in England that was looking at the effects of rabbit grazing on plant evolution. And then I also studied aphids, and in that case was kind of looking at the evolution of aphids on plant populations. So it was kind of evolution on the plant side and evolution on the herbivore side. And then I kind of switched gears after that and went to Michigan and studied restoration ecology, which was pretty plant focused, which was really focused on biodiversity down in the southeastern US in longleaf pine savannas. I was in Florida for a while doing some kind of lawn, wildflower outreachy type stuff as well. So lots of different things.
So Nash, you know, I've interacted with you on this beekeeping, or not beekeeping, but this Pennsylvania bee monitoring project, which we'll get to shortly. But I remember you talking about your experience in Guam. You were on an island out in the Pacific, I guess it is. And so you've worked with just a wide variety of organisms. And what did you do in Guam? I found that kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that one. There's a couple other projects I worked on before grad school. One, my real start was in South Carolina on this big project called the Corridor Project, which was this huge experiment that was in collaboration with the Forest Service, where they cut these experimental corridors into pine plantations, and then we're able to have these experiments that manipulated the amount of connectivity between habitat patches. which is one of the few experimental, large-scale experimental studies looking at this idea of connecting habitats and how that might benefit biodiversity. So that's really kind of my entry into research. And then with that same lab, after I guess convincing them that I was good at doing field work, they invited me to be a gave me an offer to be a field technician on this project in Guam and the Mariana Islands. So Guam is kind of the biggest island in that archipelago, but then there's the Northern Mariana Islands, which is a territory of the US, where there's three other main islands that are inhabited and a bunch of other smaller ones. So the reason we were there was because there's this big ecological disaster on Guam, which was the brown tree snake, which was the snake that was introduced sometime in World War II or so, brought over on like a cargo ship or something. This snake, I think from Indonesia initially, escaped onto the island, and over several decades, this snake killed all of the indigenous birds on the island. Because all the birds there never had evolved completely independent of any snake predators. So they have footage of these birds where they'll be like sitting on a branch, and a snake will come and eat one of them, and the bird next to it will just kind of look over and be confused and
Oh,
like eat
jeez.
the next one.
Oh, my gosh.
So it extirpated the birds entirely on this tropical island.
Wow.
It's basically still that way today. So you go to this tropical island and it's just quiet. It's really bizarre.
It's kind of sad.
So
Yeah.
that, it actually took a lot of research and convincing for to convince other people that the snake was actually the cause of this. It was actually took a lot of debate and evidence because people just didn't believe it. Like a snake could kill all the birds on an island. But eventually people agreed that that was the case. So then the researchers I was working with was saying, well, what's then the downstream effect of that? We now have a tropical island with no birds. What's the ecological effect of having no birds on an island where, lots of the trees have little berries that are eaten by birds, birds eat bugs and have effects on how the bugs then interact with the plants. So that was the idea of the project, was to study seed dispersal. How is seed dispersal different on Guam? And a few other things, but it was kind of a natural experiment because we worked on Guam where there were no birds, but then there was these three other islands, Rota, Tinian, and Saipan, which still had the birds. The snake wasn't there, luckily. So it was kind of this natural experiment. So we set up these same studies on all three islands. So I was out there helping, putting out seed traps and stuff like that.
Wow. Sounds in a lot of ways kind of like an ecologist's dream project. Like the yeah. What a cool experience. So you mentioned that your interests are kind of broad, and you've bounced around to different subject matter. Was there a moment you can kind of point to, or like a theme throughout your childhood or something that kind of led you into this type of work?
Sort of. I mean, it's kind of a maybe typical story. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest near Seattle. So we would, go camping and stuff. So I was always interested in nature and birds and forests and stuff. And be excited about seeing hawks and deer and, all that. So it was a very clear I was just sort of interested in nature. And actually the first research project I worked on in undergrad was with birds on song sparrows. We had little backpacks on birds and chased them around with radio tags. But that made me maybe not so interested in doing research on birds. It got me kind of catalyzed me being interested in bird watching, but I was like, oh, you got to wake up early. And, I didn't want my hobby to be, what I did for work in a way. So, I didn't want to do research on birds. So that's how I kind of got into plants, and things are a little more, I don't know, don't run away from you.
You also have a podcast, and I have been, in preparation for this conversation, I've been listening to a couple episodes and really enjoyed the episode about owls and what I learned about birds, and I guess animals in general, is that you were talking about how owls have those like front-facing eyes, and most predators have front-facing eyes, whereas a lot of prey animals have eyes kind of on the sides of their faces, because they're going after plants and they don't have to kind of like see something with as much definition maybe in order to chomp on it. But you had mentioned that using that, you know, that information, we can determine that Furbies are predator animals. And I found that really delightful because I had a Furby as someone who grew up in the 90s and was completely terrified by this thing that didn't seem to ever stop talking to me in the night. And so that makes a lot of sense. Predator animal has those front facing eyes, super spooky. but really enjoyed
binocular vision. It's good for tracking down prey. If you want to not be eaten, then you want wide field of view with the eyes on both sides of your head. So, and you can see that, like, if you look at birds, if you look at songbirds, their eyes are pretty on the side. But if you look at owls and other raptors and things, they have more binocular vision. So it's a pretty consistent pattern.
Well, we'd love to talk to you more about the bee monitoring project, which I know you've been involved in the last couple of years, with Margarita Uribe Lopez's lab at Penn State. And Tom, you've also been involved in this project. Do you think, Nash, you could tell us a little bit about the Pennsylvania Bee Monitoring Project, what the goals of the project are and kind of how it operates?
Yeah, so Margarita Lopez Uribe and myself, along with Tom and Val Sessler and a few other people that have helped out, have been collaborating with Master Gardeners to study the biodiversity of bees across Pennsylvania. Really, the main motivation is that there's a lot of species out there and we know surprisingly little about them. When you talk about bees, often the topic is centered around honeybees, which we know a lot about. They are of economic importance and a lot of money goes to them. A lot of people are interested in them. And there's lots of good things about that. The troubles with honeybees have increased the amount of public interest in bees more broadly. Knowing a lot about honeybees doesn't mean we know a lot about the many, many other bees that live in the world, and there's a lot of them. So in Pennsylvania, we currently know that we have 430 or so species in Pennsylvania. There's probably maybe more like 500 or more, maybe. And many, many of those have only been, you know, documented a handful of times, and we know very, very little about them. So we have these vast diversity of bees that do all sorts of important ecological things that we know very little about. However, there's, you know, a vast interest in knowing more about them, and there's, you know, economic interest in them. They pollinate crops and things. And so if we want to be know more about what's going on with them, if there's conservation concerns with them or how to manage them or conserve them, we at least need to know what species are here and where they live, which, you know, to varying, we know, you know, some about that, but not a whole lot compared to, you know, what we might know about plants and birds and lots of other things.
How long have you been doing the monitoring project, and how far out is it supposed to go?
This is our third year. And, you know, we're hoping to have it be an ongoing thing. You know, we'll see.
Can you Tom.
Oh, go ahead, Tim.
Will you be like reporting this out to, I don't know, like USDA or somebody outside of like just Pennsylvania interest?
Yeah, it's always a big question of what you do with these types of data. So the types of data we're collecting are really the most simple foundational natural history data, you know, what species live in which place and when. So we're, you know, if you think of like, you know, you might have like a checklist of what plants live in a state or what plants live in a county. Those are kind of very basic baseline types of data that we know well for some organisms, but not well for others. We know it some for bees, but not that well. So one of the simple things we're doing is creating and updating a like state and county checklist of what bees live in the state and what bees live in each county. So these are types of data that, you know, have been of interest to other stakeholders that are interested in insects and pollinators. So we are definitely excited to see who would be interested in, knowing about this. We're kind of in the early stages of using the data and what we're going to be doing with it. But in the near future, what I'm hoping to do is do an updated checklist to the bees of Pennsylvania, which would be, a publication that would, be a scientific publication. And then from that, we're also hoping to use the data that goes into that checklist to do conservation rankings for as many species as we have enough data to do, which we do hope will be of interest to, maybe state agencies that are interested in bugs or, local conservation. There's an interesting thing about bug conservation in Pennsylvania is that there is no state agency that has authority over terrestrial insects. They're called orphan taxa. There's no agency that is in control of them. So that is a big problem. A lot of states have that problem. So it is, maybe somewhat unclear what might be done in a conservation standpoint, but having more data and more information about bees might, help some agency want to step up and say, yeah, we're going to be the agency that's going to, have control over the conservation and management of insects.
So insects don't count as wildlife or interesting. Yeah, I never thought about that. That does seem like a big challenge, regulation-wise and conservation-wise.
It is a lot. And there's been some very interesting and quirky workarounds to that. For example, in the state of California, there was an effort to try to make a state ranking in conservation status for several bumblebee species that were becoming more rare. But there was no agencies that managed insects. And so they kind of used this loophole to categorize bumblebees as fish, so that they could be managed by whatever agency managed Fish and Wildlife or whatever. So there's these weird loopholes that happen sometimes. And it's weird, like aquatic insects are managed under one of the agencies, probably Fish and Wildlife or something, because there tends to be historically a lot more management for wetland things and fisheries and stuff. So aquatic insects get this coverage, but all the tens of thousands, maybe millions of bug species that live in Pennsylvania, they're not managed by any agency. They're just, ignored.
Orphans.
Yeah.
Hey,
Can
one of the things I want to mention about this monitoring project that NASH is basically coordinating and heading is the involvement of the master gardeners. There was a kind of a select group that was part of this this project, and NASH put together a really comprehensive training program, kind of get them up to speed on how to trap, how to wash these insects, pin them, do some of the basic identification. And it's been really interesting over the past 3 years to see how these master gardeners have just kind of really taken hold of the project. Their knowledge and increase on these bees is greatly increased. They've gone out into the communities and presented some of this information, and they won an international award through their Master Gardener Association. So, NASH is really kind of taking these group of volunteers and allowed them, or I guess educated them up to become these citizen scientists, and add to this body of knowledge. So it's a really neat program.
how many locations do you have around the state? Because I know, like in some counties, we're flush with master gardeners, and then you go to some other counties, particularly like the northern tier, and it's pretty light.
We have 20, about 20 master gardeners and a couple other volunteers that aren't master gardeners throughout the state. We did make an effort to select volunteers that were spread out throughout the state. When we first put the call out, we had, I think, several hundred master gardeners that applied. We didn't have a problem having people that were interested in participating in research, which I think has just been a common theme among master gardeners, is that they're very enthusiastic and motivated. I was warned not to underestimate master gardeners, and I think I continually still do. They're an amazing group. That's enthusiasm is, the most important ingredient for, I don't know, almost anything, but especially research that is kind of, tedious thing to do. So we were able to select people around the state. We were able to get a couple folks up north and east in some places where there's fewer people, which not surprisingly, there's fewer baseline bee data in those regions as well. So we made an attempt to select people that were in regions that were underrepresented. So we have one person in McKeon County, and almost every species they document is a new record for that county, because I think there was like 15 bee species documented in that county. Where, like Center County, where Penn State campus is and lots of people doing bee research, I think we have 200 over 200 bee species documented in this county. So most of the counties in the state are of similar size, so we don't really have any reason to expect that every county should probably have at least 200 bee species, whereas the vast majority of them have less than 20 documented currently. Can you
Talk a little bit about the monitoring protocol, like what this actually looks like? And, is it a certain season of the year? How often do they have to be out there?
So the core of the program are these protocols that we put together that really cover step by step all of the different processes of collecting bee data and getting it to be these museum quality specimens that can be used for this research, but also research in the future. So our goal was really to work with the relatively small number of volunteers, 20 or so, and be able to train them pretty intensively to do full research quality data collection. So we're really not cutting corners about like doing something because they're volunteers. They're really doing exactly what other bee researchers would do, actually sometimes more rigorous than other researchers do. So this starts with collecting bees, which is kind of the easy part in some way. But we have three methods of collecting bees. One is using a net. So you just go to flowers and collect bees with a net. The other is using two different types of traps. So we have these little colored bowls. They're just little souffle cups that are painted white, blue, or yellow. And those colors attract insects to the, because they look like flowers or they look weird, or and we don't really fully know why, but the colors attract bugs and they fly. And then they have soapy water in them. So they fly and they land in the water and then they drown in the water. And then there's another similar trap called a blue vein trap, which is blue and bugs are attracted to it and they fly and they get caught in it. So we have bugs collected with these three different methods and then they are stored in alcohol. And then after that, a quality specimen to use for research is pinned. So it's you have a pin through it, and then it can be stored in museum drawers for in perpetuity. However, in all of the ways we collect them, the specimens get wet because they're either getting in the soapy water, or when we're collecting them by net, we put them in alcohol. So, bees are fluffy and they have these beautiful hairs, and they get all wet, which is then they get all matted. They look like this wet dog, so they just don't look nice. So that's not fun. It's kind of we're killing these bugs for research. It's good to it feels right to bring them back to their full glory so they look nice. But there's also not just for aesthetic reasons, it actually really helps with identifying them if they're back to their nice dry fluffy glory again. So we train everyone to put their bees through the bee salon, which is this process to wash them and clean off any gunk and pollen and things, and then fluff them up using a hair dryer or shaking them around in paper towel. There's a few different ways of doing it, but basically each bee has to go through this little process of getting nice and fluffy again before they're pinned and then labeled. So we have collecting is one protocol, washing and drying is one protocol, and then pinning is another protocol because there's all little specific skills about that, ways of doing it. And then labeling them is then another process because each bee has to have, each bee actually eventually ends up having three different labels. One is a label with all of the collection information, the date, the time, the location, all of that, the collection method. And then later there's a label that is an individual number for each bee, so it can be cataloged in a database. And then finally, they get a label that has the identification, the species identification. So it's really a long process, but our master gardener volunteers go through, most of them will wash and pin all of their bees. And so when they come back to us, we have these washed, pinned and labeled bees ready to go into our collection.
You have grant money to cover the costs for all the supplies?
Yeah, we've been funded partially by a grant through Penn State Extension, a science to practice grant.
That's correct.
Getting a nod from Tom, that sounds right.
Yep.
which I actually forget if we're still funded off that. I'm not sure.
No, I think that's it was a maximum of 3 years. So I think we're done with that one. Yeah.
But that was basically enough to cover the equipment. And we also have a workshop each year where we work through all of these skills and practice all these techniques. The equipment is, you know, as far as like research goes, it's pretty cheap. It's these little cups and, you know, that's not really particularly burden budget wise. Equipment's pretty cheap. And then we've also been funded by a Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture grant that's funded, you know, primarily me and another Sarah Kania, who is our lab manager that has been processing all of these specimens. So those are our two funding sources.
I think you were describing those procedures. Those YouTube videos are still up, are they not, Nash?
Yeah.
So for anyone that's listening to this podcast, those stages that Nash described on setting the bowls out and washing them and fluffing them up, those are accessible to anybody.
Yeah, if you just search for Pennsylvania Bee Monitoring Program, and there's a webpage for the program on our lab's website, on the Lopez Uribe Lab website. You should probably be able to find that. But on the Lopez Uribe Lab YouTube channel, I posted several lectures and also these instructional videos of how this works. All of our protocols are on the website as well. You know, all of our protocols do come with a little, you know, warning at the top. We do make these things available to the public and other researchers if they're interested in that, but we're not encouraging regular people to go out and collect because, you know, there's a important ethics involved with any collection of bugs. They're beautiful, interesting, fascinating animals, and we are killing them for this research, which is unfortunate, but the complexity of studying bugs and their diversity and how little we know about them, that's still what we need to do to be able to just study where they are and who lives where. However, we're not encouraging, you know, any random person to go start killing bees for research because it's only an
I just wanted them to see do. this salon that you were talking about. It's kind of interesting. Hey, you mentioned these the bowl traps, and you know we have a backyard above ground pool behind our house, and I'm always during the summer cleaning out insects. And if you'd ever look at a Google Maps and do it on the one version, in neighborhoods you see these round blue swimming pools, and they from above they look like traps. Has anyone ever looked into monitoring swimming pools to get an idea of maybe insect diversity in neighborhoods?
That's really interesting you say that. There was just an email thread on a there's a national bee monitoring listserv because there's been this kind of national effort to talk about different approaches to bee monitoring. And just last week, I think someone mentioned that same thing and asked. Apparently during COVID, there was a global effort of these group of researchers that were just kind of bored at home during lockdown, and they started this standard protocol for making insect observations. And they just published a paper that, you know, brought together all the data that people collected all around the world to see if, you know, it could be used for various research questions. But one of the things they mentioned was that I'm not sure that data set had collected those data or not. I'm not sure, but it was part of the discussion that this would be an opportunity that could be done. I mean, it's been noticed by other people that these are essentially these inadvertent insect traps that we have all over the landscape that are, you know, would be very interesting, I think. No one chimed in saying that someone had done an analysis on that yet, though.
It would be fun to watch people go up and ask, you know, like a homeowner and go, hey, you know, can I come out and like loiter around your pool and, you know, and monitor for things out there?
You might end up in jail.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember the first emerald ash borer that I saw was in my parents' pool in New Jersey a bunch of years ago. And I was like, what is that? And, you know, unfortunately, they became very numerous. But yeah, I think that's a great idea. I'm curious about the data that you're getting. Have there been any big surprises that have come up? Like, wow, we really didn't expect to see that species in that part of the state. Or is it at this point kind of just developing a baseline because that information isn't there yet?
There's been a lot of unique discoveries. A few of them I still haven't been able to get fully confirmed yet, because when you have something new, it, you know, it's hard to find the right person to be able to verify it. But one example that that comes to mind right now is a master gardener in I forget where this was. It's a small town, and it's right next to a big river. I can't remember the names of places in Pennsylvania, unfortunately. Sorry. Anyways, it's this kind of small town next to this river, and she collects almost exclusively just in her yard. So we always ask our volunteers to have at least one spot where they collect repeatedly throughout the year. I actually remember someone asked me earlier about how often you collect that I didn't answer. We try to ask people to collect at least a couple times a month, you know, during the time of year when bees are active. So we have at least one location where they're repeatedly sampling. So this master gardener collected a bunch of this Andrina, which is a mining bee, which are these really, that's the most diverse group of bees in Pennsylvania. There's probably about 100 species in Pennsylvania. They're really diverse. Most of them are active in the spring. So when you go out really early in the spring, they're the ones that are often visiting blueberries and apple trees and all sorts of other spring ephemerals and things. But there's also a few of these bees that are active in the fall, and they tend to be specialized on things in the sunflower family. Most of the bees in this genus, Andrina, are specialized on something. So this one species, Andrina asteris, I believe it's called, not surprisingly, is specialized on asters. And it's been found in Pennsylvania, but only a few times. So it was kind of cool that she found that in her yard. But then pretty much all bees also have other bees that parasitize them. So about 15% of bee species are called kleptoparasites. They don't collect their own pollen. They sneak into the nest of other bees and steal pollen and then use that to lay, you know, to lay their own eggs on.
Whoa.
So they're thieves. So there's this group of Andrina that are super diverse. There's like 100 species. And then there's this other group of kleptoparasitic bees called nomada or nomad bees that are mostly kleptoparasites of Andrina. So there's this diverse group that kind of evolved together, the host Andrina and the parasites nomada. So there's a specialist parasite that is a specialist on this Andrina, and it's never been found in Pennsylvania before. And she found like 15 of them in her backyard.
Whoa.
So she had the host and the parasite in her yard, and both were rare, and one of them had never been discovered before in Pennsylvania. So those are the types of things that, I mean, that bee could be very common in Pennsylvania. It might be all over the place. We just, you know, and it's probably patchy and just happened to be in this person's backyard.
Hey, one of the things that you do with this Master Gardener group is you have a reading club, and you send out papers and ask them to read them, and you get together and discuss them. And you sent out a paper about a week or two ago about honeybees and the interactions with the native bee population. And I mean, I know a little bit about this issue, but I guess I didn't know the extent of maybe some of bigger issues with honeybees and their interactions with native bees. And you know, I kind of knew the one was that there's a a resource issue. There's only so much pollen in the landscape. But, you know, reading through the paper, there are multiple other issues that are occurring out there with these native bees and honeybees. And as you alluded to earlier, you know, honeybees serve a role in production agriculture, but maybe this needs to be a little more looked at.
Yeah, for sure. You know, honeybees is a complicated and sometimes contentious, discussion point, especially for folks that think about these wide diversity of native bees. So, you know, and actually, you know, in our lab, we study honeybees as well. So, both are important. But if you're thinking about conservation and things that are about biodiversity and the environment, honeybees aren't really good for any of those things. They're actually can be pretty problematic in that they're incredibly abundant. So they compete with native bees. They just consume a lot of resources. So one of the studies we're going to talk about next week, I think, actually was just this crude estimate of how much food honeybees actually eat. And so, you know, we think that it's, I wish I remember the exact number, but I think it was like one colony of honeybees eats enough food to feed 20,000 native bees or something like that. And then they also just compete directly. So there's all these documented cases of honeybees actually going up and like grabbing bees and stealing pollen off them directly. So just like directly competing with them and stealing pollen off of them. And then they also have the possibility of sort of behavioral changes. So if a plant is covered in honeybees, the native bees might just be like, nah, I'll go somewhere else. So just kind of these behavioral effects. There's also some research suggesting that honeybees may be moving diseases and parasites around. And that's sort of an ongoing thing. It can actually go both ways also. So some of the native bees are spreading diseases to honeybees and vice versa. It's complicated, but that may be, especially for bumblebees, there's a parasite that is linked to some of the problems with declines in bumblebees that seems to be maybe moved around by honeybees. So there's just a lot of things going on with honeybees. And if you start just sort of thinking of them as, you know, I like to think of like starlings. If you starlings are a non-native bird, they can be super, super abundant, and it's kind of maybe easier to visualize what effect they may have in a landscape or how they might be interacting with other birds. They'll steal nesting sites from other birds and all these things. It's really very similar with honeybees, although I guess honeybees, they have a beneficial effect. I don't know if anyone's claiming that we're getting a benefit from starlings, but anyways, they're from a biodiversity standpoint, I consider them honeybees an invasive species because of all the potential negative effects they can have on native bees and plants and things.
I remember reading a paper in grad school about this researcher. I went to University of Maine, and she was studying farmers' perceptions of native, I think particularly bumblebees, on blueberry crops as pollinators. And one of the farmers noticed that on rainy days, none of the honeybees wanted to come out of their hives because they didn't like to get wet, but the native bumblebees were like out there doing the work and getting wet and not really minding that the weather was bad. And so it seems like there is, there are pollinator advantages or pollination advantages to these native bee species, and they kind of maybe because they're more adapted to the climate or the weather or something like that. But I thought that was cool. That always stuck out to me that, you know, these little, despite being super fluffy, the bumblebees were out there in the rain, which sounds really, really sweet.
That is a very good observation, and actually a global analysis of the effects of pollination by honeybees and native pollinators really kind of confirmed that anecdote, which was that in all crop systems that were studied in this meta-analysis, it showed that having native pollinators had a benefit to crop yield even when honeybees were there. So having native pollinators always helped. Adding honeybees only sometimes helped. But having native pollinators always helped, even when honeybees were also there. So the short conclusion is that in all systems studied around the world, native pollinators are always helpful, and that honeybees cannot replace the services that they can do, because they can just never add up to the amount of successful pollination that native pollinators can do.
Yeah, well, this is obviously really important work. I was lucky enough to transport some of the bee boxes from Philly to State College recently, and took a little peek at some of the boxes, and was amazed at how professional and how professional they looked, and also how many species were collected at you know, an arboretum down the street from me. So really awesome project, and we're about at the point where we start wrapping up here, and just want to say thank you so much, Nash, for talking to us about the bee monitoring project and also some of the other work that you've been doing. We always end our podcast with the same question of our guests, which is, what do you like to do when you're not working?
Because you mentioned species, one more bee thing. I think just so we found over 200 bee species so far, probably going to be, you know, I think we're at 240 right now. So in a couple of years, we've documented 240 bee species, which I think is just really amazing. So
that's, it's amazing. Yeah.
Fascinating the amount of diversity that's out there. The two main things I like to do are bird watching and playing music. Bird watching is, you know, maybe not as new and different, but I like bird watching. The Christmas bird counts are coming up, so I'm participating in, I think, three of the Christmas bird counts.
Nice.
If anyone doesn't know, that's a annual kind of tradition that every year there's a place where there's a, you know, standardized count of birds, and there's ones all over the world that are done around Christmas time. So I like participating in that. And then I play music in a classic rock cover band called the Rocket Blasters. So we play gigs. most weeks we're out playing gigs. We often, you know, typically play these 3-hour gigs at social clubs and bars and stuff. We're, you know, playing, you know, I play a lot of like Neil Young and Creedence Clearwater Revival and,
nice.
You know, Black Keys and White Stripes and stuff like that. So I play guitar and sing and a little bit of harmonica. So yeah, that it's a fun thing to do. And they actually even pay us a little bit to do it, which is surprising.
Oh, nice. Well, I hope the Black Keys and White Stripes aren't considered classic rock just yet, but they might be lumped in
maybe.
There.
I play Seven Nation Army Black Keys, and I'm like, oh, here's a more recent one. And it's like, well, it actually is like 22 years old or something.
20 years old, yeah.
Starting to seem a little classic now. Yeah.
We play some new stuff too. So we have another singer, Stephanie, sings some songs. So she does like a Lady Gaga song. So we do a few new things in there as well. But yeah, I think that late 60s, 70s stuff is our main catalog.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Nash. This was an awesome conversation. Lots of really interesting stuff that you're involved in, and we appreciate you being a part of our show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. All right. Yeah, take care. You.